This is Audible.
Blackbeard Superbox. This set is a compilation of volumes written by Michael Wallace and performed for you by Steve Barnes, comprising the books of the Starship Blackbeard series. Starship Blackbeard, Lords of Space, Dreadnought, and Rebellion of Stars, as well as the books of the Sentinel Trilogy, The Sentinel, Dragon Quadrant, and Shattered Sun. And now, the story begins with Book 1 of the Starship Blackbeard series, Starship Blackbeard.
Chapter 1. The warning light flashed yellow on the airlock door, and James Drake braced himself to be ejected into space. His pod contained several other court-martialed Marines and space sailors, also strapped into their seats, also headed for the helium-3 mines of the system's outer worlds. He didn't know how long the others were in for, and he didn't care. Didn't even know if they were innocent or not. It was only the injustice of his own sentence that burned him, the disgrace to his good name. 2 years. You can survive that. He guessed that his 2 years of hard labor was one of the lighter sentences, the last perk of being an officer. Only 2 years, long enough to get him out of the way as the Navy mopped up untidy details in the aftermath of the war. But if the Admiralty thought he'd return docile, begging to be readmitted, they were mistaken. The instant he finished his sentence, he would return to Albion to fight the injustice that had sent him away, fight to regain his commission, find out whoever had framed him for the destruction of the merchant ship. Through the transparent partition, he could see the second pod, also preparing for ejection. Not human in there, but long-limbed, pink-skinned Froom. Their fate was more grim still. Instead of being fired toward the mining ship, they'd be launched toward the Slaver, now in orbit around Albion, to be shipped to the Sugar Worlds and worked to death. Terrible criminals, supposedly. Most likely, poor dumb civilians caught on the wrong side of the war. A cool, clinical woman's voice came into the pod, a computer. The crew of Ajax called her Jane. He supposed it was the last time he'd hear her voice.
20 seconds to launch. Prepare for rapid acceleration.
The yellow light flashed faster now. The man next to Drake whispered the Lord's Prayer in Old Earth English. A chaplain, he'd tried to lead them all in prayer minutes earlier, but one of the Marines had cursed him and his god. This time, all were bracing themselves for a pop, a hiss, and a giant fist to slam them into their seats as they hurtled outward.
10 seconds, Jane said.
Drake looked out at the beautiful blue and green sphere of Albion one last time. The island continent of Canada stretched below, verdant and beautiful, with the Zealand Islands curving from the west coast into the ocean like a string of jewels. He looked for his home island of Auckland, but it was covered with clouds. He'd spent his childhood dreaming of the day he'd turn 16 and join the Royal Navy and get off that boring rock. Now he wanted nothing more than to sit in the sleepiest pub in the sleepiest farm village with his feet warming in front of a peat fire. This latest mission aboard HMS Ajax had lasted 17 months, almost a year and a half in deep space, spending blood and treasure for the kingdom, and he'd only made it home for 3 days. Then arrest, court-martial, and sentencing. One nightmare after another, until here he was, strapped down in this pod. The injustice of it felt like a hand tearing at his heart. Worst of all, he didn't know where to direct his rage, who had betrayed him.
5 seconds.
Drake shut his eyes and counted silently 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 0? Jane's voice came through again.
Recalculating, 8 seconds. Recalculating, 10 seconds.
The ship shuddered. A malfunction, he thought. A defective transport pod. He opened his eyes. The slave pod was gone. It had launched, disappeared into the black void. But Drake and the other criminals were still strapped into their chairs.
Pod 11 launched,
Jane's voice whispered in her soothing computerized voice.
Aren't we Pod 11? Someone asked.
Life support readings normal, Jane continued. Pod 11 docking with transport ship in 37 seconds.
You dumb tit,
one of the men said to nervous laughter.
Hey, Captain,
someone else said.
Ain't this your ship? What's wrong with her?
Maybe it's no mistake,
said a young Marine with the Albion Lions tattooed on her right forearm.
My commander could have issued a pardon.
Someone snorted at this, a loud braying laugh like a donkey.
Could be,
she insisted.
I punched him in the nose when he cheated at cards. Gave me 30 bloody months for that. Nobody cares,
someone else growled.
So shut your gob.
Someone else took exception to this, and soon the prisoners were arguing.
Keep quiet,
Drake said, annoyed by the chatter. He knew his ship and was listening for familiar sounds, like a man with a cranky furnace who knows what is wrong by its groans and hisses.
Nobody asked you,
one of the men said, the one who'd started the arguing in the first place. He was a burly man, older, with a saber scar across one cheek.
Anyhow, you ain't captain of this ship no more, so stop acting like it.
Like the others, Drake was dressed in a pair of brown overalls with a red prisoner circle over the chest, but the others had recognized him at once. Apparently they kept up on the news in the planet-side jails.
Captain better watch his back,
another man said, this one dark-skinned and with a wolfish smile. He was the one who had been defending the woman with the lion tattoos.
In the mines we're all equals, eh? No man got any rank. Plenty of tools are lying around. Accidents happen. Know what I'm saying?
There was a hint of nervousness in the laughter that followed. Drake wasn't worried about the implied threat. Some people were bullies and cowards. Others craved leadership. He imagined how it would go. They would test him. He would fight back and win. An officer in the Royal Navy, even disgraced, was a man of breeding, culture, and education. Much of that education was in how to dominate those of a lower station. The natural order would not change simply because he had entered a prison camp. The ship shuddered. A familiar rumble vibrated through the hull. That was Ajax's plasma engines firing up. She rolled slowly away from the planet. What the devil? Did they really not know the capsule had failed to launch? And why were they moving anyway? 4 other ships came into view. 2 were light corvettes, the 3rd a cruiser like Ajax, long and lean and hungry-looking. The 4th was the Lord Admiral's flagship, HMS Dreadnought, looking like a wounded monster of the deep, her sides scarred with deep gashes from where the enemy had raked her with kinetic fire. Dreadnought dwarfed the orbital fortress at her rear, where she would be in repairs for weeks. Some of Drake's fellow prisoners began to laugh. They seemed to be thinking the same thing, that there had been a malfunction, and nobody realized they'd failed to launch. They'd now go off, well, wherever Ajax was headed. Problem was, she wasn't supposed to go anywhere, which Drake knew, but the others didn't. These weren't his men and women, but a random collection of discipline problems. The Lord Admiral had put Captain Rutherford in command of Ajax while he chose a new captain, but Drake guessed that his first mate, Commander Jess Tolvern, was the actual officer at the helm. Tolvern was a capable officer, but she didn't have enough experience to earn her bars yet. In any event, she was tainted now. They were all tainted. Tolvern had tried to testify at the court-martial, had argued angrily that the charges were false. Drake's pilot was caught falsifying permissions to hack the Royal Navy defense grid to get records of the battle. He'd probably lost rank as a result of that little stunt. Tolvern may not have lost rank, but defying the Admiral would no doubt hold back her career for years to come. She'd been her typical self in court, sarcastic and abrasive in the face of injustice. Navy barristers had called her to the stand, hoping that she would pin blame for the disaster on her commanding officer's shoulders, but had shortly declared her a hostile witness. As a result, the Admiral didn't even trust her on an interim basis. He'd put Captain Rutherford in charge of Ajax. Drake's old ship would continue in orbit until the board approved a new commanding officer. So where was Tolvern going? Ajax wasn't the only ship in motion. Dreadnought remained in place, but the other three ships began to turn in their direction. After a moment of what looked like hesitation, Ajax's sister ship, Vigilant, didn't follow, but presented a broadside. The cruiser's outer shields retracted, hiding the Lions of Albion and showing the black, snub noses of cannon.
"King's bulls!"
the woman with the lion tattoos cursed. The other prisoners fell silent, staring out the window. The plasma engines were still warming up and hadn't reached critical. A double thump vibrated through the hull, this at a lower frequency. That was the warp point engine coming online. It took several hours from ignition switch to jump, but it burned so much energy just to contain the reaction that it was only turned on when it would be used. More cursing greeted this.
"We're bloody trying to jump?"
someone cried.
"I don't believe it, we are. We're going to run.
Captain, what's going on?"
Of course, now they all looked to Drake for leadership, now that their stones were on the anvil. He didn't answer. But he knew. He suspected the other prisoners did too. "Tolvern, you fool." His first officer was leading a mutiny. Chapter 2. Drake wasn't surprised when the airlock opened and Jess Tolvern appeared. She wore a tight red combat jumpsuit without insignia that showed her lean, muscular body. Her hair was in a bob, the current military fashion for women, and she wore pistols in holsters on each hip. Her green eyes flashed with the confidence that always looked just shy of arrogant. Tolvern was only 26, 7 years younger than Drake. He'd given her a brevet during the Battle of Kif Lagoon, when his former first mate had been killed in a broadside from a Hroom sloop of war. A shell had punctured the bridge, and the man had been sucked screaming into the vacuum of space. Promoting Tolvern had caused some controversy, and Rutherford had privately asked Drake if he wasn't promoting her in part because of a connection to her family back in Auckland. There was nothing inherently wrong with loyalty to an old family from his father's estate, Rutherford assured him, so long as she was qualified. Drake assured his friend that Tolvern had proven herself. Sure, she had a good deal to learn, and was a commoner, but she possessed a remarkable ability to keep cool under fire. So he had ignored Rutherford and any other doubters. Now he wasn't so sure.
"Get the prisoners out of here,"
she said over her shoulder to others who were crowding in from the hallway.
"We need room for..."
"No," Drake cut in. "This stops now."
Tolvern looked back at him.
"Sorry, Captain, but no. We'll argue later if you like. For now, do what I say."
She came over, holding an electronic key, its chain wrapped around her fist. She swiped it over his harness, and it clicked unlocked. Drake didn't get up.
"I'm not going anywhere."
"King's balls, do you have to be so difficult?"
He hooked a thumb at the viewscreen, showing their surroundings. The three Navy ships had their cannon exposed now, and even Dreadnought had turned a pair of deck and belly guns at them, although he knew these would not be loaded with live ordnance. Ajax was pulling slowly away from the opposing ships, but the other vessels, minus Dreadnought, were beginning to give chase.
"You will get us all killed," he said, "and my ship blown to pieces."
"Hardly. We caught them by surprise. They'll need time to get those guns up, and they know it too."
She grinned.
"You should hear the threats coming over the comlink."
Tolvern grabbed for him, as if to help him up, but he pulled back. Some of the other prisoners were hollering for her to unlock them, too. Others begged her to surrender and leave them be. They wanted no part of this.
"Get up, Captain," she said. "For God's sake!"
Drake was still staring at the viewscreen and saw the flash of light. It didn't come from any of the ships, but the orbital fortress servicing Dreadnought.
"There she goes," he said, not surprised in the slightest. "Brace yourselves."
Ajax rocked. An explosion boomed through the ship, coming from what sounded like the aft shields. It knocked him out of his seat before Antigrav could stabilize them. When he got up, Tolvern was shouting, pushing her way back up the hallway. Men poured into the pod from the corridor, dragging prisoners who had their hands cuffed. Dwight Barker, Drake's chief gunner, was among the mutineers.
"You," Drake said. "I thought you would know better than this."
"Don't just sit there gaping," Barker said.
"I'm not gaping. I'm wondering when this farce will end."
"Get him out of there,"
Tolvern called from the corridor. Barker grabbed him, and this time he didn't resist. His best bet was to get to the bridge and take command. Once he did, he could order his crew to stand down so he could surrender as bloodlessly as possible. Do that quickly enough, and he might be able to plead mercy for his crew. Even an aborted mutiny would bring down the wrath of the Admiralty. Best case was that Tolvern's little stunt would earn her her own multi-year stint in the mines. Probably Barker and the others as well. Better than a hanging, he supposed, but completely avoidable. He pushed through the handcuffed prisoners in the hall. One of them was Captain Rutherford, wearing his bathrobe, of all things, his hair wet, as if he'd been dragged from the shower. The man looked livid as Tolvern pushed him along. Rutherford and Drake had fought side by side several times in the war. They'd scattered a larger enemy force, won a victory that was sure to earn them both a hero's parade down the streets of Yorktown, from Kingdom Tower to the Royal Palace. That was before the frame-up.
"Mutiny!"
Rutherford said, glaring as they pushed him past Drake in the narrow hall.
"Are you an idiot?"
"I swear I know nothing about this," Drake said. "But I'll put an end to it, mark my words."
"You had better. Malthorn will blow us all to Kingdom Come."
"Not you," Tolvern said. "You're going home." Rutherford wheeled on her, looked like he would have struck her if his hands hadn't been cuffed behind his back.
"Curse you, Tolvern! If this is your doing, I'll see you hanged!"
He started to spit something else, but they shoved him and the other prisoners into the pod. It was going to be crowded in there, unless Tolvern had been stupid enough to order the existing prisoners released. Lights were flashing in the hall, together with the siren calling all hands. Didn't seem to be many hands available. Another shot rocked the ship, closer this time. The smell of burning plastic filled the air, and a red light flashed at an entrance to their right, indicating their airlocks had sealed off part of the ship in that direction. Barker caught up with them in the hall, and Drake turned to him.
"If you're here, then who is at the guns?"
"Nobody. We're short-handed, as you can figure."
"Short-handed and short of brains."
A wry smile from the gunner.
"You might say so, yes."
Barker was an older man, thick about the middle, and with a walrus mustache. Almost 60 years old, and though his skills were not what they had been 10 or even 5 years earlier, he'd once been one of the best gunners in the fleet, and had a long way to slip before he was merely average. And clever, too. Could have been chief engineer, if he'd been more ambitious, or of higher birth. Barker's involvement in this scheme was surprising. Not only had age made him sensible, but he seemed to look down on Tolvern as young and callow and female. The older man had joined the Navy when women were wives, daughters, maybe even whores in distant ports, but never space sailors, and certainly never officers. So why was he following her into this madness? When they reached the end of the hall, they ran into another group of several prisoners being driven by two men with guns and stun batons. Most of the prisoners were unfamiliar, probably part of Rutherford's crew, but two were engineers Drake had known for years. They should be putting out fires and sealing damaged airlocks, not being jettisoned with the rest of the prisoners. The men driving them, on the other hand, were the head cook and his assistant.
"We won't be able to repair hull breaches," Drake said, "but we can still bake a mean shepherd's pie. Let's get this surrender over with."
He said this last bit as they came onto the bridge. Tolvern moved to the viewscreen, which was split between zoomed views of the battleship Dreadnought and the cruiser Vigilant and the two corvettes beginning to give chase. The corvettes were quicker out of the blocks than the cruiser, and their engines fired up more quickly. By now, they must be hauling away from Albion at perhaps 20 miles a second and accelerating rapidly.
"Get to the gunnery decks," Tolvern told Barker. "Scrape together whoever you can find."
"But hold your fire," Drake called after him. "Await my orders."
"Does this mean you're taking command?"
Tolvern asked when the gunner had hurried off. She sounded eager.
Drake grunted. "Of a mutiny, only long enough to end it."
Another blow rocked the ship. So far they'd taken several shots from the fortress's cannons, and another that felt like it had come from one of Dreadnought's pea-shooters, but hadn't responded in turn. Good. Drake hoped to bring this to an end before anyone died on either side.
"Pod 11 launched," said the same computer voice that had been so wrong a few minutes earlier.
This time Jane was right. Drake watched as the pod arced away from the ship and disappeared.
"Did you reprogram its trajectory?" he asked.
Tolvern winced, which gave him his answer.
"Only now we're out of position," he said. "So instead of making their way for the mineship, Rutherford and the rest of your victims are jammed in a tin can, hurtling toward nothing. Wonder how long it will take to haul him back in, and how angry he'll be when they do."
"Rutherford is your friend. He'll forgive you."
"Not after this, he won't."
"He'll understand," she insisted. "I gave him the chance to join our jailbreak. Thought for a minute he'd accept."
Drake gave her a hard look.
"He was no more likely to join a mutiny than I was."
"Stop using that word. That's not what this is about. It's about getting you out of here so we can prove your innocence."
Drake looked back to the screen to see lights flashing from the side of the opposing cruiser. They were out of range of Vigilant's cannons, but that didn't keep her from launching missiles. The missiles sped past the two corvettes, who still gave pursuit, and accelerated toward Ajax.
"Well,"
Tolvern said, sounding a little discomforted, less self-assured, for the first time since she'd burst into the away pod.
"That was faster than expected."
"Aft force shields,"
Drake said, more out of habit.
"Already done," she said. "I knew they wouldn't get their cannons up in time. Well, except for the little guns from the fortress, but we took those blows. All we have to do is get to point one light, and we'll be at jump speed."
The nearest jump point to Albion, only one of four in the entire system, was close but tight. That meant with their mass, they needed to be cruising northward of 18,000 miles per second, close to Ajax's top speed. That would take time. Nobody was sitting in front of the defense grid computer, which was charting, in big purple splotches, the kinetic weapons still blasting out of the fortress and the big battleship. Nobody sat in the pilot's chair either. Manx worked a computer in one corner, speaking into a headset to the engine room. He was a bosun, and normally he'd be down below. The only other person on the bridge was Tech Officer Smythe, a young man with the square jaw, intense expression, and broad shoulders of a fighter pilot. In reality, he was a computer geek, one of those guys who could run diagnostics on the engines on one half of the screen while he played a video game on the other. Now, his fingers were flying over the keyboard and across the screen as he tried to keep the hull pressurized.
"We're not jumping," Drake said.
"But why not?"
Tolvern asked.
"Admiral Malfoyne is worked up by the jailbreak. He needs a chance to think clearly before he does something dumb. We'll get you out of here and wait for the fleet to settle down. Then, when we can prove what really happened..."
"Shut up, Tolvern, I need to think."
First step was to keep them from dying. He glanced at the defense grid computer, which showed the first missile impacting in 1 minute and 52 seconds. The second would hit a second or two later. Two more missiles, these showing red, had just fired from the cruiser. They accelerated slowly, appearing at first like they'd be left behind. That meant they were bigger, probably something two-staged, with a fissile sting. If the first missiles weakened the shields, the second pair would certainly finish them off.
"Drake," Tolvern said in a worried voice. "What do we do?"
"What are our numbers? How many joined your little scheme?"
17.
He gave her a hard look.
"That's not even a skeleton crew."
"You can do it. I know you can. Just tell me what to do."
"Get on the defense grid. We'll absorb the first two missiles and pray Barker launches countermeasures before we take the next two."
"Then what?" she asked.
"Drop shields and come to a full stop. Tell them we're surrendering and hope the Admiral is in a forgiving mood."
"For the love of... you can't do that!"
She had started to sit down at the defense grid, but now sprang to her feet.
"After everything we've done for you?"
"You've done nothing for me, blast you. Now do what you're told."
The only hope was to survive the missile attack and then stand by helplessly and hope that Admiral Malthorn called off the dogs. The dogs, in this case, were the two corvettes, which were already gaining on them. Under better circumstances, he could outgun them, but not with the cruiser wallowing outside of Albion, still hammering with missiles. And the orbital fortress would be scrambling short-range fighters. The grid showed 20 seconds to impact. He braced himself in the captain's chair. Tolvern touched her comlink and fiddled with the computer as she spoke to whoever was at the gunner decks, hopefully Barker. She raised her voice.
"You don't stop them and we're all dead!"
"Brace for impact," Jane said. "Class 2 detonation expected."
She spoke in the same calm, soothing voice that had promised him he was about to be jettisoned toward the mining ship. Now she was warning him that he was about to have a missile stab through the shields and bury itself in the hull before detonating. Manx flared the plasma engines at the last second, hoping to burn up the missiles, but whoever was on the other end had prepared for this, and the two missiles came swooping in at angles. The first missile thrust up into Ajax's belly, while the second dove from above. There was a double shock, like a pair of staccato drumbeats, followed by two huge, thumping explosions. The chair held him in place, or he'd have been thrown to the floor.
"Status?" he said. His voice was tight.
Tolvern let out her breath.
"Damage to C-deck. Engine 2 emergency shutdown protocol."
"In a hull breach?"
"No."
"Thank God," he said.
"Warning,"
the computer said. Did her voice sound strained this time, or was that his imagination?
"Class 3 detonation expected."
Class 3. Bloody hell.
"Barker!"
Tolvern shouted into the headphones. Lights flashed on the defense grid, chaff coming out the back end of Ajax. Drake's thumb manipulated the controls on his chair to show the region of space behind the now sputtering second plasma engine. They were still accelerating with only one engine, now up to 473 miles per second, with the anti-grav's disruption field the only thing keeping them from being smashed into jelly against the back wall of the bridge from all the acceleration. But, of course, they needed to be closer to 18,000 miles per second to reach point one light and jump out of the system.
"Reverse thrust," Drake ordered. "Bring us to a halt. Drop shields."
"But, Captain..." Tolvern protested.
"Do it!"
Tolvern fiddled with her computer and gave commands to Manx. Manx spoke up from the other side of the bridge.
"We can't, sir. Engine 2 is damaged and bleeding heat. If we slow down, we'll melt the back half of the ship." "Dump the core." "Negative, sir. Coupling damaged. She's good if we keep accelerating. Otherwise, we're goners."
Drake clenched his jaw.
"Bring us to the minimum speed needed to equalize temperatures. Tolvern, hail the fleet. Tell them the situation."
But either communications were knocked out, or the fleet wasn't responding. Malthorn would be frothing at the mouth by now. It beggared the imagination that the Admiral would be trying to destroy one of the most powerful cruisers in the fleet, a ship that cost £100,000 and was the pride of the Belfast Space Yards. But the screen showed the second round of missiles closing, and the two corvettes almost within range for their kinetic weapons. Maybe they'd stop when the shields were obliterated and the engines gone. Or Maybe they'd finish Ajax off with lasers.
Tolvan, what were you thinking?
What kind of question is that? You were framed for the death of those Marines, and I'd be damned if I'd see you shipped to the mines. It was you who taught me loyalty.
To the Crown, not to me.
He touched his comlink.
Barker.
Here, sir.
His gunner's voice rasped in his earpiece. A glance at the defense grid. 4.5 minutes until missiles 3 and 4 hit. It was like watching death in slow motion.
Do you have a crew?
Jacobs is here, and 2 of those prisoners you freed. Woman with the Albion Lion tattoo seems to know what she's doing.
Can you stop those missiles?
I got a plan for that. Not so sure about the corvettes, though, not running for our lives like this.
I want the forward gun ready. Forward missiles, too.
The forward gun?
Barker sounded confused.
And make sure everyone is seated and you've got disruptor fields and antigrav in order, or you'll all be smeared against the floor.
Tolvern wasn't stupid. Her sharp look told him she understood.
You're turning around?
Yes, we are going back. But not to surrender. Not now, anyway.
But what about Dreadnought? Vigilant is back there, too, firing missiles. And Fort William.
No time to argue. I need someone at the helm. Computer isn't going to do it.
Tolvern took a seat in the empty pilot's chair, looking like a child with its high back. It had been built for Nib Pym, a Hroom who was over 7 feet tall, his limbs even longer than that height would suggest. She had to stretch to reach the controls. Drake sat down. Invisible hands held him in place. He passed general orders through the ship, similar to those he'd given his gunner. Then he ordered them brought around. The ship turned, but if not for the spinning view on the screens, he wouldn't have felt a thing. Tolvern pulled them around as fast as she could, without tearing apart the mechanical systems, and soon they were shooting back toward Albion, now upside down relative to the corvettes bearing down on them. They still weren't going more than 1,000 miles a second, a speed so slow it felt like treading water compared to the 0.1 light that they needed to gain before the jump. But they'd more than doubled their effective speed relative to the enemies coming at them. The corvettes flashed past in the opposite direction, no more than a few miles off port. They struggled to turn. The missiles were more maneuverable than the cruisers and banked in a hurry. Barker launched more chaff and 2 radiation pulses. The screens went white. When they regained focus, there was no sign of the missiles. The corvettes were now 50,000 or 60,000 miles distant. A ragged cheer went up from the other 3 people on the bridge. No time to relax. They were closing in on Albion several times faster than they departed, and accelerating. Drake didn't attempt to come in at an angle, knowing that the entire network of orbital fortresses would be on high alert already, but instead ordered Tolvern to bear down on Vigilant and Dreadnought, as if prepared to ram them. The corvettes were once again gaining at their rear. Dreadnought had slipped its tether and was preparing its main guns. Vigilant maneuvered into an angle to rake Ajax with enfilading fire. Fort William had its own cannons.
"Sweet mercy," Tolvern said. "We'll be torn apart."
Drake ignored her. Into the headset, he said,
"Don't fire until we're past the cruiser. Then give her all guns."
"Not Dreadnought, sir?"
Barker asked.
"No, Vigilant is our only threat."
He'd better be right. The battleship, the fort, and the pursuing corvettes were all poorly positioned. They could not shoot at Drake's ship without shooting at each other. Blowing up Ajax to abort a mutiny was a brutal step. But to finish the job, Dreadnought would risk the pursuing corvettes, too. And the corvettes hadn't yet realized it, or they'd be veering away instead of pursuing. It was Vigilant who posed the threat, since she alone could shoot at Ajax from an angle. Ajax streaked by her sister ship, and both launched broadsides at the same moment, cannons blazing with shot made of cobalt rods to penetrate the shields, and explosive shot to tear into any resulting holes. Had Captain Rutherford been on his ship, he would have stayed still, letting his gunners and targeting computers have the best possible shot. But Rutherford was hurtling through space in a passenger pod with no engines, and whoever had taken his place on the bridge was considerably more cautious. He rolled away from Drake's shots and expelled as much ordnance trying to bring down enemy fire as to attack Drake's ship herself. Ajax slipped by, nearly unscathed. In a flash, they were past Fort William and skipping across Albion's uppermost atmosphere. Even the near vacuum 100 miles above the planet was enough to slam into them at these speeds, and the ship shuddered like a lorry hitting a pothole before it skipped off into outer space again. 2 more orbital fortresses opened fire as they blazed past, but nothing hit. They were racing into the void once more. Word came from the engine room that they had repaired the coupling on the second plasma engine. If the captain wanted, he could order it jettisoned and bring the ship to a halt, then stand by and wait to be boarded. Tolvern stared at him.
Well?
Malthorn will be screaming for blood, Drake said. Vigilance shields were poorly positioned. We hit her pretty hard when we went by. She'll be a week in the yards. We might have even killed someone.
He glanced at the screen. The speed was 3,400 miles per second and climbing. The corvettes had come around the planet, but they were falling behind now. Even with Drake's ship wounded, the corvettes would never catch him in time. Only Vigilant could do that. But there was no sign of her. Again, he was lucky that Rutherford was out of commission.
"So you're not surrendering?" Tolvern pressed.
"Not yet, no." He turned it over. "The Lord Admiral won't let this go. The helium mines will be too good for us. We'll all hang, every last one of us down to the cook."
"So we jump out of here?"
"We jump," he agreed reluctantly. "Where can you take us?"
"I've got the first jump pre-programmed. After that, I'm helpless. We'll need a pilot."
"Make your calculations. Where are we going, Griffin Shoals?"
"Where else?"
Drake nodded. Of the jumps directly from the home system, that was the only one that wouldn't get them killed. It was also a place he had never dreamed of visiting, not unless he was leading a small fleet ready to clean it up. Never as a fugitive. He studied their speed as they accelerated. Soon they were at 10,000 miles a second, then 11, closing in on 18,000 miles per second, almost 1/10 the speed of light. Lights began flashing at 17,000. Jane's soothing voice warned that a jump was imminent. In principle, the physics were not much different from the temporary wormholes that could shoot a small object a few billion miles here and there throughout an individual star system. In practice, the disorientation was more severe the further you jumped, and it varied from person to person, with some weak-minded new recruits losing their minds the first time they went through.
"Prepare to jump," Jane said.
Ajax entered the wormhole. He suddenly felt stretched, his brain seemingly outside his body. For a few seconds, he swore he was floating down a passageway with the antigrav turned off. His body remained safely in the captain's chair while his consciousness floated past the crew mess, the quarters, the entertainment deck, and into the engine rooms, where he could see the plasma engines still radiating heat though they'd been snuffed upon entry into the wormhole. When he regained his senses, they were 11 light-years away, outside a small, cold, red sun, in the system known as the Griffin Shoals. He was a fugitive and wanted man. Chapter 3. Drake waited in the war room. The lights were dimmed since Ajax was drifting through space with all but essential systems dark. If Admiral Malthorn had sent ships through to look for them, Drake didn't intend to make it easy. But even the dim light seemed bright over the post-jump headache that was currently splitting his temples. Tech Officer Smythe entered first, blinking and shaking his head like a dog coming out of the water. He sat opposite the captain at the big oak table and immediately pulled out a handheld computer whose blue glow reflected off his face. Turning on the computer seemed to be a reflex as Smythe stared at the screen with a glazed expression. "You look stunned, Smythe. Hope you don't have the trips." The tech officer looked up slowly.
"Huh? What?"
"The trips, like you hit your head." Drake had meant it as a jest, but the longer it took Smythe to respond, the more he worried that it wasn't a simple jump concussion, but that the man really had come out of the wormhole with his brains scrambled.
"No, sir. Little sluggish is all."
Jess Tolvern came in next. She had a steaming hot towel twisted and wrapped around her neck. She looked at Drake with a grey, sickly expression. Some people came out stunned. Others kept their wits but lost the contents of their stomachs. The first mate was a puker. She'd changed out of her red combat uniform to a grey service jumper. After emerging from his own stupor, Drake had gone back to his quarters. Only when he'd staggered up to his door and put his palm against the reader did he realize they'd probably changed the lock and cleared out all of his possessions. But no, his prince opened the door, and he looked about, surprised to see everything where he'd left it. It had all happened so fast. The Marines arresting him in his quarters, the false accusations, the rapid trial and sentencing, while his crew scrambled to find evidence to exonerate him. His room was neat and tidy, every one of his possessions where he'd left it. He'd stripped out of the brown overalls with the red prisoner circle, shoved them down the incinerator chute, and put on his standard service uniform with captain's bars.
"Where's Barker?" Tolvern asked.
Even as she spoke, the door opened with a hiss, and Dwight Barker came into the war room. His eyes were red and watery, and he squinted at the lights. Drake looked at the three of them, then cast his eyes at the empty chairs around the conference table. No pilot, no second mate, no staff officers.
"Did anyone have a plan?" he asked.
"We had one," Tolvern said. "And it worked, didn't it? Here we are. Nobody was killed. We figured you could take it from here."
"That was your plan, to limp into shark-infested waters bleeding from every orifice and hope none of the sharks were paying attention. Wouldn't surprise me if half the scavengers and salvage operations in the system were winging their way here this moment."
"I don't think they are," Smythe offered meekly. "The computer says..."
"Screw what the computer says. Pirates don't survive out here by telegraphing every move."
There were only 4 possible jumps from Albion, which was one of the reasons why the home planet was so defensible. The Hroom frontier systems had been accessible from at least 12 different systems each. During the war, Albion and her allies had sent in fleets from 3 locations. Twice, the battles of Epis III and Kif Lagoon, Drake himself had led Albion forces in glorious victories. As for Albion's jump points, one took you so close to a neutron star that you and all your equipment would be fried before you got away from it. 2 of the remaining jumps came into well-fortified systems that were Albion protectorates. The 4th was the Griffin Shoals, a barren system with no habitable planet. There was a small watch station on the 3rd planet to send a warning back to the home system, but the rest of it was the domain of pirates and smugglers. They hid among the vast number of asteroids and rocky moons, taking advantage of both the system's proximity to the wealthy Albion home system and its launching point to all manner of Ladino, New Dutch, and Hroom planets.
"By now they've found Rutherford and hold him in," Drake said. "Malthorn will have Vigilant and 12 other ships jumping into the system to hunt us down."
Tolvern shrugged as if affecting nonchalance, though she wouldn't meet his gaze.
"Like finding a needle in a..."
"They're going to burn down your bloody haystack until they find us," Drake interrupted. "We're wounded, and we've got 17 people in our crew. The Punisher class calls for a minimum crew of 52, a full deck of cards, and there's not a single Royal Marine on board."
"We have 24 crew members, actually."
"You told me 17.
"We did. Now we have 24. 17 in the jailbreak."
She only just stopped herself from saying mutiny, Drake could tell from the hesitation.
"Plus 6 prisoners we liberated from the away pod. And you, of course."
Drake took a deep breath. He could feel his blood pressure rising until his pulse pounded at his temples.
"You impressed the criminals. What are we, a pirate ship? May as well run up the Jolly Roger and be done with it."
Barker started to say something, but Drake waved him off.
"Here's what I'm going to do.
We're going to put the criminals in the brig. Then I'm going to hail the scavenger settlements in the asteroid belt. Soon as someone answers, I'm stuffing the lot of you into the remaining pods and launching you out. Make your way as fugitives, if you can. I'll send a subspace to the fleet and wait for them to take me in.
You can't do that, Tolvern said. Captain, listen to me. What they did to you was an injustice, a travesty. People die in the mines, or they do something wrong, and the next thing you know, they're off to the sugar worlds. And that's the end. You know it's true.
None of that matters. I didn't turn against the fleet before, and I won't do it now. Besides, he added, I had a plan. Rutherford knew I was innocent. He was going to get me out. Rutherford is an opportunist, Barker said from the end of the table. Now that you're gone, the door is open. He'll be the second officer of the fleet before long, mark my words. And you, Drake said, turning on the gunner. I'm shocked. I can see how Tolvan roped in the rest of these fools, but you? What were you thinking? I was thinking that loyalty is the number one lesson you taught us. Loyalty to the crown. I've been in the Navy since 98, Barker said. 32 years. 3 kings and 1 queen. I've had 7 different commanding officers. Not one of them gave 2 spits whether I lived or died. You did. That's where my loyalty lies. Seeing the look of fierce determination on the gunner's face gave Drake pause. Barker's defiance was mirrored by Tolvern's jutting chin, and even Smythe had put down his computer to give a curt nod of agreement. And so you went along with a mutiny, because you didn't want me to face 2 years in the mines? Drake asked, still speaking to Barker. You've got a wife, 2 sons, and now a granddaughter. You might never see them again. To save me from hard labor.
Aye.
Drake didn't know whether to be touched by the man's loyalty or give him a good shake.
Not just you, Barker said. Also Nib Pym.
Drake leaned back in his chair.
Yes, what of him?
Tolvern had already said that something had happened to the Froom pilot. Drake assumed it had something to do with how Nib Pym had tried to hack into the naval computers to prove his captain's innocence. After that stunt, Drake imagined the pilot had been reassigned to a military transport vessel or some other lowly position. You didn't throw an experienced, highly skilled pilot from the service for what amounted to an indiscretion. There weren't 3 people in the Navy, human or Froom, who could match Nib Pym's navigational skills.
He's on a galley filled with Froom, Tolvern said. They're on their way to Hot Barsa.
Hot Barsa, one of the Sugar Worlds. A former planet of the Froom Empire, it was now given over to the production and export of cane sugar. The heat and humidity were such that humans could only survive if they moved from one air-conditioned space to another, which meant that the labor force was almost entirely Froom slaves, producing the very poison that had brought their ancient civilization to its knees.
As a pilot, Drake asked.
As one of the slaves, Tolvern said.
Drake was horrified.
But he's not. He'd never touch the stuff.
We don't know how or why, she said. They threw him in the brig for a few days. By the time he came out, he was an eater. He attacked 2 military police, put one of them in the hospital, lost his freedom for that.
Drake tried to picture his calm, analytical pilot shoving sugar into his mouth, and failed. Addiction came on quickly, but it had only been 2 weeks since he'd last seen Nib Pym. And already he was an eater? You know, Smythe said, fingers moving over the screen of his handheld computer, you can get to the Barsa system from Griffin Shoals in 5 or 6 jumps.
The galley only left 2 days ago, Barker said. We can get ahead of it.
Not without a pilot, Drake said. It might take 2 days to get out of here if we use the computer. Then we're just as likely to end up back at Albion. So, unless you want to go sniffing around the system to see if there are any unemployed, desperate pilots idling about, looking for a suicide mission.
We already have a pilot of sorts, Tolvern said.
She seemed to be regaining some of her confidence, and the captain had the impression she was still holding on to information.
There's another person on board with a nav chip implanted in her head.
Who's this person? Drake scoffed. I've never met her.
One of your fellow prisoners. Name is Henny Cap.
Tulvern tapped her right forearm.
One with the lion tattoos.
The Marine. A nav chip is an illegal augmentation. How did it go undetected?
It's been disabled since she enlisted, Tulvern said. Smythe says he can reactivate it.
Easy enough, Smythe said, with a nod. What's this Cap woman doing with a nav chip anyway? Drake waved a hand. Never mind that. You knew, that's the point. You planned on using her all along, didn't you?
Once we learned she could pilot, yes,
Tulvern said.
That was the missing piece of the puzzle.
By puzzle you mean mutiny and treason.
If there's treason, it's not our doing, Tulvern said. Captain, think about it. It was a Hroom ship we shot up. Forget what the Tribunal claimed. You know. We hauled in wreckage and saw bodies, alien tech, Hroom Empire stuff. We all saw it with our own eyes. It was not an Albion trader, and there sure as hell weren't Royal Marines on board.
You'll notice that Malthorn yanked away the rest of the fleet and let us finish the job, Barker said. That way there were no witnesses.
Rutherford too, Tulvern said. Vanished at the most convenient time.
He's not in on this, Drake said, his faith in his old friend unshaken. I swear it. Anyway, the Lord Admiral had just cause. You've seen how the flagship was mauled in the fight. Malthorn only won the battle because Rutherford's fleet showed up at the last minute. I don't know why we were accused of destroying the traitor, but I don't question the Admiral's military decisions.
The battle was won, Tulvern said. The enemy forces scattered, and everyone was hailed as a hero but you. You found the enemy fleet, knocked out a carrier, and wiped out the ship carrying the Doomsday device. But no, they say that you attacked the wrong ship, killed a bunch of our people instead.
I'll be exonerated. I'm not worried about this.
Sir, she continued, listen to me. We didn't wake up cranky and decide to mutiny. You don't know everything that happened after you were sentenced. At first, I thought they'd let us stay together, but Nib Pym was sent into slavery, and then Assistant Pilot Jones got himself run over by a lorry while he was on shore leave. After that, the fleet said screw it, and scattered the rest of us. Well, we would have been scattered anyway. Practically every member of your crew got sent elsewhere.
Even the company of Marines, Barker added.
That's right, she said. Spread all over the colonies. Smythe, show him.
The tech officer tapped his screen twice before sliding his computer across the table. It showed a list of Marines, sailors, officials, even down to Ajax's cabin boy, together with their future assignments. No two people would be serving together.
Wouldn't surprise me if they meant to rechristen Ajax, Tulvern said. It would have been like we'd never existed as a crew.
Drake was still staring at Smythe's screen and the note across from the assistant pilot's name. Hit and killed by a lorry while on leave in Yorktown. Coroner said he'd been drinking. He tapped the screen and showed it to Tulvern. You don't believe this, do you?
She glanced at it and met his gaze. You tell me. Jones liked his grog, no question. But suspicious that he'd die now. The pilot is in slavery. The assistant pilot dead. Bloody suspicious.
Yes, that's what Drake was thinking. He'd been stripped of his commission and sentenced based on false testimony. It wasn't the careless attack on the merchant ship that had done it, but that he'd supposedly tried to cover up his crimes by falsifying logs, even hauling in alien wreckage to make it look like he'd done what he'd claimed. He'd even managed to fool his crew, according to the court-martial. All of it false. Until now, he'd assumed that someone else had accidentally attacked the friendly vessel, and in the chaos of battle, blame had fallen, erroneously, on his shoulders. That would have been very different than a conspiracy. But now, he was not sure. The frame-up looked intentional. To what point, he could scarcely fathom. Merely to hide someone else's blunder? How would that necessitate getting rid of his pilots and scattering both Ajax's crew and the Marines posted to her?
Henny Cap, you say?
he asked, and she says she can pilot a Punisher-class warship.
Who knows? Tolvern said. We didn't exactly chat about mutiny beforehand.
Mutiny. There it was. Good for Commander Tolvern for owning her actions. Smythe held out a hand for his computer. He tapped a few times.
Says Cap navigated a merchant frigate, was fired after a couple of bad jumps, tried to join the Navy as a pilot, was turned down, so she let them disable her nav chip and join the Marines instead.
Drake grunted.
And you knew all this before?
More or less, Tolvern said.
We didn't have much choice. Anyway, all we need is to get Nib Pym back, and we won't need her.
Drake recalled what the prisoner had told him when they were failing to launch in the pod.
Cap said she'd punched an officer. Is that what she was in for?
The officer was her lover, she said. Tried to end things, and she got violent. He lost a rank for his role in the matter. She took a sentence in the mines.
Lovely. Speaking of rank, what is she?
Corporal.
So, not an officer. And from her coarse accent, low-class riffraff, as his father, the Baron, would have said, she had no business in the pilot's chair. Drake had seen enough of a man's, or woman's, natural abilities to know that class, character, and rank didn't always match. A commoner could be just as honorable, hard-working, and intelligent as someone of better breeding. But this Cap woman seemed to have none of those qualities. Except what was his choice? Muck around the star system looking for smugglers and pirates to see if he could find someone better? For that matter, should he even go after Nib Pym? What if he were seeing what he wanted to see? If this whole business was a mistake, he should surrender, turn over the ship to the Navy, and return to suffer the judgment of king and country.
There's a conspiracy, Tolvern said. We need to get to the heart of it.
Aye, Barker said. That's my inclination too.
Inclination or desire, Drake said.
Trust your instincts, Tolvern urged. They never led us astray before, and they won't now. What do they tell you to do?
Okay, he said at last.
Bring Corporal Cap to the bridge. First, we find out if she's capable. Then we see if she's willing. The other three leaned forward in their chairs.
And if she is? Tolvern asked.
Drake sighed. Then we find our pilot and rescue him from slavery.
Chapter 4. Captain Nigel Rutherford came through the airlocks of Dreadnought and walked stiffly down the hallway toward the lift. His neck was so sore that he could barely turn it from side to side. He was already late to see the Admiral, but couldn't bring himself to hurry. Probably better if he got hold of his emotions first. He was in a foul mood and not feeling favorably inclined toward Malthorn, or anyone else for that matter. He'd spent 17 hours in his bathrobe, trapped in a jettisoned away pod with 18 other sweaty, grumbling victims of the Ajax mutiny. After the first few hours, Rutherford had despaired of ever being rescued. Commander Tolvern had simply flung them into space without a pre-programmed trajectory, and the search area had expanded geometrically as they raced away. Just a blip in the cosmos, impossible to locate. When Rutherford was a fighter pilot, one of his mates had been lost in space after being forced to eject from his ship, his distress beacon broken. A wretched way to go. But no, someone had noted their trajectory and, when the fleet could be bothered, finally sent someone to fetch them. About bloody time. 5 more minutes and he'd have throttled every last person in the pod with his bare hands. He caught the lift, turned his whole body to push the button to take him to the officer deck, then waited for the door to shut. A young ensign came running down the hall just as the doors began to ease shut.
"Hold the door, sir," he gasped.
Rutherford held out a hand to the young man.
"No, take the next one."
With his other hand, he mashed the door closed button. He went up alone. He was in such a foul mood that he felt a twinge of malicious satisfaction to see the young man's look of dismay.
he too was late for an important meeting, it would seem, let the boy get a flogging for all Rutherford cared.
Wonderful. I've turned into Captain Bloody Bligh.
He could finally see Bligh's point of view in the old Earth story about the mutiny on the Bounty. Sometimes what was needed for discipline was a good old-fashioned whipping. People in the kingdom, and especially in the fleet, tended to romanticize the stories of the British Empire, America, and all of that other English history from before the Great Migration, but not that one. If Albion ever needed to invent an indigenous religion, Captain Bligh would make a prime candidate for the role of the devil. Maybe Napoleon or Hitler would also serve, but they seemed a little too much like real historical figures. Then who would be the Albion god of his new religion? Admiral Horatio Nelson? Queen Victoria?
George Washington,
he said with a chuckle as the doors opened.
The thought of a god with a powdered wig amused him enough that he was feeling more cheerful, albeit still in need of a hot shower and a massage, rather than this unwanted meeting, by the time he rang at the Admiral's quarters.
Malthorne's staff officer welcomed him in. The Lord Admiral was lounging in a chair near the viewscreen, only the back of his head visible. An outstretched hand held a snifter of whiskey. Through the viewscreen came a milky white swath of stars, spread like a glittering snowy arch through the sky. But the ship was moving, and the cool blue and green sphere of Albion rolled into view.
"Captain Rutherford to see you, my lord,"
the staff officer announced before backing out.
"Lord Admiral," Rutherford said, and waited.
"What do you say about your traitor friend now?"
Malthorne asked, without turning to face him. Rutherford's improved mood soured. He made his way over to the Admiral without answering. It was night over the Eastern Hemisphere, the twin continents of Britain and Australia visible, separated by the Irish Sea, which was more of an ocean than a sea, nearly 1,000 miles wide and littered with islands. Australia was fat and wide and southern, like her old Earth namesake. Britain was long and thin, stretching from the equator almost to the North Pole. The glittering metropolis of Yorktown sat on Britain's eastern coast, a single glowing light, with a spider web of cities radiating north, south, and west. York was by far the biggest city on the planet, with nearly 5 million people in the greater metropolis.
"They say the population of Albion will reach 500 million this year," Malthorne said, as if he'd been thinking the same thing. 5,000 settlers to 500 million in a little over 600 years. Another 50 million living on Saxony and Mercia. We have been amazingly prolific. And yet..."
"My lord?"
Rutherford said, confused.
"The Hume Empire once numbered in the tens of billions. The aliens still outnumber humans 20-30 to 1.
"And it is said that there are more sheep than people in the Zealand Islands," Rutherford countered. "That doesn't mean the shepherds are in danger of being overthrown by their flocks. The Hume are a broken, tired people, destined to be a servant class. We are young and energetic."
"Perhaps, perhaps."
Malthorne turned in his chair and gestured for Rutherford to take a seat. Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorne, Duke of the Boston Plantations, had been born to one of the richest families in Britain, if not all of Albion. In addition to his estates on Albion, he also had extensive holdings on Mercia and the Sugar Worlds. He was King Bartholomew's cousin, and his wife was the Queen's half-sister. With his sharp, penetrating gaze, high, balding forehead, and eagle-like nose, Malthorne looked more regal than the king himself. Whenever Rutherford found himself alone with the Admiral, he was aware of the difference in their stations, both by birth and rank. Like his old schoolmate, James Drake, Rutherford had grown up in the Zealand Islands off the coast of Canada. His father was a minor baron, and he had gone to school with merchants' sons and daughters, had attended church with the families living on his father's estates. It wasn't until the Naval Academy that he fully appreciated Albion's class divides.
It wasn't only the traditional classifications, peasants, laborers, priests, merchants, and nobility, but within the nobility itself, there were further divisions. Rutherford hadn't seen the admiral's staff officer re-enter the room, but now the man brought over a silver tray with two tumblers of whiskey. Malthorn replaced his empty glass with a new one, and Rutherford took the other. The whiskey was smooth, with hints of oak and peat.
"From your homeland," Malthorn said. "The best whiskey available, unless you somehow find yourself in possession of old earth scotch, which, I regret to say, hasn't passed my lips for many a year."
The liquor warmed Rutherford's belly and eased the stiffness in his neck. It also loosened his tongue, and against his better judgment, he found himself wanting to discuss Drake and the missing Ajax. "He's no traitor, my lord. He'll return."
"He's had more than enough time already," Malthorn said. "It has been 20 hours since they jumped out of the system."
"Maybe he thinks we'll kill him. Harbrake made a good attempt at it during the mutiny. Would have done it, too, if he'd been more alert. He let Ajax slip right past Vigilant and escape."
"I am well aware of Captain Harbrake's limitations."
Malthorn smiled, but it was an unpleasant, toothy grin, lacking humor.
"Perhaps if you had been alert yourself, you could have stopped this. Instead, you let a conspiracy pass undetected right beneath your nose."
"An error that I regret, my lord," Rutherford said, forcing humility into his voice.
"You were taken in the shower by a woman, a commoner. Good God, man, why didn't you fight back?"
Rutherford didn't answer.
"And before that," Malthorn pressed, "you could have showed leadership at any point, crushed the rebellion before this commander, this commoner, had inflamed the more excitable members of your crew."
"Yes, my lord." It wasn't Rutherford's crew, of course. The conspiracy must have been afoot long before he took temporary command of Ajax, only a single day before Commander Tolvern broke into his room and burst in on him while he was in the shower. She held a pistol and gave him three choices: join the mutiny, surrender as a prisoner, or die if he resisted. Rutherford was armed with a bar of soap. What could he have done? Malthorn sighed and looked out the window. The planet had rotated beneath them, and they were now looking at daylight rising over the new Atlantic, the vast, islandless ocean between Albion's eastern and western hemispheres.
"You were not the best captain in my fleet, Rutherford."
"No?"
"Only number 3, you understand."
What kind of nonsense was that? How many dozen men had command of a ship in the Royal Navy, and he was the 3rd best in the entire fleet? There was no shame in that.
"But your betters, McCreary and Drake, are no more. McCreary has a proper excuse. He gave his life in service to his king and country. Drake is another matter. He made a blunder, and has compounded that blunder with one treachery after another. Better he had died. That leaves you, Rutherford. You're the best now. God help us. You'll need to bring him in."
"Not Harbrake?" Rutherford said, innocently.
"No, not Harbrake, the fool. Caught with his trousers down by Drake's little maneuver. No, you're the best man for the job, especially if given proper resources. The question is, are you sufficiently loyal to do what needs to be done? Or will you face your old friend in combat and let him slip away because of some misguided sense of camaraderie?"
"My loyalty," Rutherford said, "is to my king. No bond of friendship would break that."
"I would have expected the same words from Drake's mouth. And yet, here we are. Ajax missing, and Drake a traitor. He might be 50 light years away by now. Or he might be hiding on the dark side of the moon waiting to launch a treacherous attack. How will you find him?"
"He jumped to the Griffin Shoals."
"I know that, you fool."
"What I mean is that he's probably still there because he doesn't have a pilot. Harbrake has sent ships to search for him. He intends to bombard pirate redoubts and take prisoners. But I doubt the dreck of the system will have anything useful to say,
if they've seen Drake in the first place.
My time is too valuable to hear a regurgitation of facts already in my possession.
Yes, my lord, my apologies. The system is big and scattered. Heartbreak didn't send enough forces to do the job properly. There may be other pilots. Once Drake finds one, he's sure to jump again. I suggest you send another task force to augment Heartbreak's ships.
Heartbreak had taken as flagship his own cruiser, HMS Nimitz, a sturdy if somewhat outdated aggressor-class cruiser, together with frigates, corvettes, and a destroyer. Malthorn finished his whiskey and waved away the staff officer when the man tried to give him another.
"And if we don't find Drake before he jumps again, what is he likely to do next? Where is he likely to go?"
"I hope he will surrender, my lord. He didn't want the mutiny. He told me as much when I was being shoved in the capsule with the other prisoners. Once he has regained control of his ship..."
"His ship?"
"Excuse me, of Ajax. Once he has regained control, he will most likely surrender, while seeking some sort of amnesty or accommodation for his crew. He won't want to see them hanged, regardless of their crimes."
"And when he doesn't surrender?"
"If he doesn't..." Rutherford began, then stopped to think. What was James Drake's primary character trait? Loyalty, yes, to king, crown, and country, and also to his friends, to his crew. Rutherford owed his own position in part to Drake's assistance over the years. They'd formed a friendship all the way back in the academy when the two middle sons of minor barons made a pact to someday rise to the heights of the Admiralty. Drake had risen first and fastest, but had always reached back a helping hand. Of course, he never let on that he was the one pushing for his friend's promotion, but Rutherford heard it from other sources. Drake had spoken highly of him to the Lord Admiral, or had praised his actions in some minor battle or skirmish. During the war, he'd given Rutherford plenty of chances to show his qualities. Rutherford had no doubt that if he were the one unjustly accused of destroying a trade galleon from the York Company, accidentally killing Royal Marines in the process, and then covering his mistake, Drake would have seen to it that he was exonerated. Drake claimed he was innocent, and his friends on Ajax all believed him, so Rutherford had been working to this very end when the unfortunate mutiny occurred.
"Captain?"
Malthorn said, as the silence stretched beyond a few seconds.
"What happened to Drake's pilot?" Rutherford asked. The Admiral blinked.
"The room fellow, what of him?"
"I'd heard he was thrown in the brig for improprieties related to the naval computer network, but he never came back to the ship. When I tried to track him down, Ajax could hardly fly without her pilot. He seemed to have disappeared."
"Is this relevant?"
"It may be, my lord. That depends on what has become of the room."
"Someone gave him sugar while he was in the brig. By the time he came out, he was an eater. You know how they are. There was an incident. The end result is that the fellow is on a slave galley being shipped to Hot Barsa."
"I see," Rutherford said. This was strange. Not so much that the pilot would find himself under sugar's dizzying, addictive spell. The room were helpless before it. When humans had met the Empire 200 years ago, it had been at the apex of a 1,000-year expansion. Within a few generations, the civilization lay in shambles. Millions of whom were now working on the sugar worlds, bent in the very sugar cane that had sapped their race of any other desire than to get the next sweet fix. But how was Malthorn privy to such details about the whom pilot, when the interim captain of Ajax had been unable to track down the simplest details? And what Rutherford didn't tell the Admiral, but had discovered, was that Captain Drake's entire crew, down to the company of Royal Marines that had been on board, had been scheduled for dispersal throughout the fleet. An entire new crew would man Ajax henceforth. Who had made such an order? There was no record. The order seemed pointless, so Rutherford countermanded it. His countermand was countermanded in turn. By whom? That was unknown. There were maybe 12 men and women in the fleet who could have done it,
and Rutherford had been in the process of discovering who when the mutiny struck. Now he suspected he knew the answer. The Lord Admiral himself had given the order. He must have caught wind that there would be a mutiny. Then why hadn't he warned Rutherford, or taken any other measures to secure the ship?
"And you think Drake will go after this room?" Malthorn asked.
"Yes, or rather no. I think he will surrender. But if he doesn't, that is the logical step."
"A waste of time. His pilot is already an eater."
"Froome can recover from that," Rutherford said. "Drake will think so anyway. He will feel responsible for what happened to his pilot and attempt a rescue and a detox. Ajax has no pilot. Drake needs one, and he'd just as soon use the one he knows."
"That will take time," Malthorn said. "And more time still to find the galleon."
"When did the slaver set out?"
"A few days ago. Her name is Henry Upton, and she's a slower vessel as anything in the York Company fleet."
"But she still has a head start," Rutherford said. "My guess would be that Ajax and the slaver would arrive in the Barca system at roughly the same time."
"And what do you propose to do?"
"I suffer no such shortage of pilots, and I have fast warships at my command. I'll take Vigilant and a task force of frigates and torpedo boats. The Third Fleet is in the Barca system already. I'll warn them that Ajax is on its way. If I set out now, I can arrive before either Drake or the slave galleon, set a trap, and wait."
"And when you find him, what will you do then?"
"Whatever you wish of me, my lord."
"Demand Drake's surrender. If he refuses, destroy him. We cannot risk Ajax free in the space lanes."
"Yes, my lord." A leaden weight settled in Rutherford's stomach at the thought of attacking and killing his old friend. But what choice did he have?
"There is one thing. You will not take a task force. Only Vigilant. Do not announce your destination or your intentions. Set out via the Jericho system instead of a more direct route for Barca. I'll make sure the Third Fleet is out on maneuvers."
"My lord?" Malthorn rose to his feet and stepped up to the window. He gestured for Rutherford to join him, and the younger man obeyed. Dreadnought had once more circumnavigated the planet and was above Britain. Clouds had come over Yorktown, darkening the center of the continent.
"There are enemies in the Navy," Malthorn said, his voice low. "Men who would take advantage of Drake's treason, who would send him aid, if they could find him."
"Who are these people?" Rutherford asked, shocked by the accusation. "What do they want?"
"I don't know who they are, not yet. But they want to overthrow King Bartholomew. That is their ultimate aim. For now they hope to foment civil unrest. To that end, I want this mission to be secret. When you have taken Drake, one way or another, I want you to come to me quietly and tell me what you have done. Do not broadcast your victory to the fleet."
"I understand, my lord."
"The other mutineers are to be put in the brig under strict quarantine. They are not to see anyone nor to send or receive messages of any kind. I would prefer that none be killed in the engagement. My intent is to interrogate them at length, but my primary desire is not that they be protected. They are, after all, criminals of the most vile sort. Should some or even all of them be killed in the engagement, it would be no great loss."
Again Rutherford thought of the orders given to scatter Ajax's crew among the fleet. The Admiral must know something, or think he knows something, about the men and women under Drake's command.
"Yes, my lord. You can count on me."
Chapter 5. Drake took Tulvern with him down to the crew mess. They were midway through a 42-hour slog between jump points, and the enlisted men and women were drinking, playing cards, or relaxing with vidsets. The air smelled of cigar smoke and booze. A man was telling a filthy joke about Froome mating habits when the officers entered. Someone spotted them and cleared his throat. The joke died on the man's lips. It was the fellow with the saber scar across his cheek who'd been rescued from the pod during the mutiny. The man who'd sneered that Drake was no longer captain, he sat down in a hurry, and the room quieted. There were roughly a dozen people in the mess, and of them, fully half were rescued prisoners. The only one of the prisoners who wasn't present, in fact, was the Church of Albion minister who'd been praying the Lord's Prayer in Old Earth English. Tolver nodded to the corner. Henny Cap, the Royal Marine who'd been serving as their pilot, sat behind a mug of grog, her arm draped possessively over the shoulder of the dark-skinned prisoner who'd threatened that Drake had better watch his back in the mines. Fraternizing was a serious offense, and the man acted like he wanted to edge away from Cap, but she made no effort to move her arm. Neither did she try to conceal the full pint of grog in front of her, what looked like a double ration.
"Care for a drink, Captain?"
she asked with a grin as Drake and Tolvern pulled up chairs.
"Figure the likes of you got good wine and beer, not this piss-flavored water, but personal taste and all that. Give the word and Cook will pour you up."
"The computer finished running," Tolvern said. "According to Jane, we're not on any known charts. You've taken us 2 jump points into deep void. That's quite a trick."
Cap rubbed a hand over her shaved head, as if feeling for the nav chip buried in her skull.
"You gave me 2 weeks to get us to Barca, and I'm getting you there in 10 days. Seems I should be on the receiving end of some gratitude here. So what's with the suspicion?"
Drake reached across the table and rolled up the woman's sleeve to show the golden lions rampant on Cap's forearm.
"Patriotic sort to get the Albion lions tattooed on. Old tattoos, too. But you've only been a marine 6 months. Before that, you were some kind of smuggler?"
Cap thrust out her chin.
"Yeah, but I'm reformed. Ask your computer, bloke. It's all in the database, right?"
"We're cut off from the database, as you bloody well know," Tolvern snapped.
"Well, excuse me if I ain't privy to that detail."
The commander looked ready to snarl something else, but Drake put a hand on Tolvern's arm to calm her. She needed to learn that sometimes the best way to get information was to let the other person do the talking. Cap's male friend moved to extract himself. His name was Ronaldo Carvalho, and he was from one of the Ladino planets, though Drake didn't know anything else about him. He mumbled something about reporting for duty. The mess had cleared out except for the cook, who now went around clearing glasses and wiping up spills with a bar towel. Cap scowled after Carvalho as he slipped out the doors, as if annoyed that he'd left her alone. When she looked back at the captain and the commander, she didn't seem quite so cocky.
"What's all this about? Am I in some kind of trouble?"
"You got the lions on your arm because you were just that patriotic," Drake said. "It was only then that you joined the smugglers and pirates of the Griffin Shoals. Then, about 6 months ago, you had another change of heart and joined the Royal Marines."
"I couldn't get in before, and that's the honest truth. I wanted to be a pilot in the Navy, but I failed the tests. Said I wasn't smart enough. But you know what I think?"
"Why don't you tell me?" Drake said.
"I think it was on account of my birth, you know. I wasn't officer breeding nor education. At least they admit it in the merchant fleet. Wouldn't let me pilot there neither. But out in the shoals they ain't so fussy."
"You were a pirate?"
Tolvern asked in a sharp tone.
"No, I mean, I fell into, well, into some bad company. Smuggling and the like. You got that figured out, right? Then, I don't know. Bug kept itching at me, came back to Albion to try again. They still wouldn't let me pilot, but they let me enlist in the Marines. Figured I'd see some action that way."
"Is that so?" Drake said.
Cap looked between them both.
"I don't understand. I'm doing right by you, ain't I? We're most of the way to Barca already, and ain't nobody found us yet."
Drake nodded at Tolvern. She reached for her waist, which made Cap flinch, but it wasn't to get her sidearm. Instead, she retrieved a computer from her hip pocket.
"Jane isn't too sure about this," she told Cap, "but she seems to think we're going to jump about here."
Tolvern pulled up a chart and showed it to their would-be pilot. It was the Santa Maria star system, with 2 planets under nominal control of Ladino colonists from the final wave of human immigration from Earth a couple of 100 years earlier.
"That's right," Cap said. But there ain't no other way to get to Basel from here, not directly anyhow.
Seems like a good place to strip down a captured Albion warship, Tolvern said. Outside control of the Crown, and maybe someone figures the King won't start a war over a ship that had been taken in mutiny already. A lot of money in that.
Your friend from the Jettison Pod, Drake said. The one you were fraternizing with earlier. Carvalho, isn't it? He's Ladino. Wouldn't happen to be from the Santa Maria system, would he?
I don't know, I never asked him. Listen, I'm telling you, we gotta go through Santa Maria unless you want to fight the Navy direct. Then we rev up the engines and come into Barca from the Outer Worlds. We jump closer and we'll run into the Third Fleet, frigates and cruisers and everything.
Drake fixed her with a sharp gaze. The woman looked back without flinching, which showed steady nerves.
You've done well so far, he said. Moved us farther and faster than I could have hoped.
I ain't so good past Barca, afraid I'd get us lost. These inner systems I know pretty well. What are we doing there anyway, Captain?
You let me worry about that, he said. Just get us safely to the Barca system. If there are any surprises, any treachery, I have the means to crush it.
Ajax was still wounded from her recent scrape with Vigilant, but he had no doubt this was true.
Ajax is a Punisher-class warship, he added. I don't expect any aspiring pirates would be so foolish as to attack her. But I always keep my guard up, Corporal. That is what necessitated this visit. I'm sure you understand.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
I don't trust her, Tolvern said, as she accompanied the captain back to the bridge.
I don't see as we have any choice in the matter.
Drake was happy to get away from the smell and sloth of the mess. He'd seen better discipline among the prisoners in jail while awaiting his trial. And he was tired. He'd been up for 20 hours and needed sleep. But first, he wanted to check progress on the hull repairs, as well as make sure that the second plasma engine was functioning as it should. They really needed a fortnight in the docks. But where would he go? To Santa Maria with a crew of 24 and no marines?
If Cap got out a subspace message, Tolvern said, we might find a whole crew of pirates and the like waiting to strip us for scrap.
Maybe. Or maybe she's come around. She'd be in the mines now if it weren't for the mutiny.
That's not going to change her nature, Captain. The woman is still a smuggler at heart. And she's apparently taken up with this Ladino. What's he about?
They came onto the bridge. Tech Officer Smythe was the only one in the room. It was disconcerting to stare at the wide, nearly empty space. All the screens, from the nav computer to the defense grid, were scrolling displays for crew who were not present. When Smythe turned his chair to consult another display, even he disappeared from view. And for a moment, Drake felt as though he were looking at the bridge of a ghost ship, hurtling through the cold black void at 11,000 miles per second. When Drake was a young ensign aboard HMS James Cook, they'd found just such a ghost ship while on a reconnaissance mission. It was the shape of a turtle and the size of a small city, cruising along at the relatively sluggish pace of 2% the speed of light. When it was towed in, it was discovered to be some sort of generation ship, but ancient, thousands or even tens of thousands of years old. Those long silent years had left its surface pitted and scarred. There was no sign of passengers or crew, or even indication of what kind of race had been on board, though people had assumed humanoid. Those were the only sorts of aliens so far discovered. But for all Drake knew, it had been built by a race of super-intelligent octopus. Whoever they were, there was no trace of them. No sign of who they were, or why they'd left. How many such ghost ships wandered the empty voids of space? Some of them, he knew, were human, their engines failing, their final passage uncharted.
"Do you still intend to surrender?" Tolvern asked, when he'd taken the captain's seat.
"I don't know," he admitted. "I'm not keen to fit my head into the hangman's noose."
"This is my fault," she said.
He turned with a raised eyebrow. "Why, yes, yes it is.
but now that I know what happened to Nib Pim, I'm more inclined to forgive you. We could hardly see him shipped off to die in the cane fields of Hot Barza.
That's just it, she pressed. That's my loyalty. You are loyal to your crew, and your crew returns those feelings.
That wasn't your oath, he reminded her.
Damn the oath, I couldn't let you fall for something you didn't do. It was a bloody crime, and I had to stop it.
2 years, then I meant to return and clear my name.
The death rate in the mines is 12% per year. Smythe looked it up.
Only the weak ones die. I am not weak.
No, Captain.
A funny look came over her face.
You are not.
To answer the question, I'm going to find out who turned my pilot into an eater before I make any decisions. Not one word of that story makes any sense.
You think some larger plot is afoot?
Don't you? He asked.
Jane's voice came over the calm.
400 million miles to destination. Estimated 19 hours and 20 minutes before final acceleration required.
Drake smiled at his first mate.
Practically there already. Only 400 million miles to go.
True to form, Corporal Cap hadn't known the jump points closer to the planet, so they entered the Barza system in the middle of the gas giants, another 500 million miles from the rocky inner worlds. Smuggler routes, of course. When they popped out, a couple of tramp frigates were rendezvousing a few 100 miles away, no doubt exchanging illicit cargo. They caught one glimpse of the big Navy cruiser and fled for their lives. Cap, sitting in Nib Pim's pilot's chair, took some time picking out Hot Barza from a vast swath of stars, planets, and other objects visible from the sector. Scans found no unusual ship traffic in the region, so when she found the planet, Drake simply pointed Ajax in its direction and fired up the engines. Soon, they were hurtling inward as fast as they could travel, and still keep cloaked from subspace radar. The Third Fleet was lurking around here somewhere, he knew. Maybe no carriers or battleships, but certainly a task force. They were close, both to Ladino worlds, and systems teeming with room. In other words, it was an ideal intersection between a sugar world, huge sugar markets, and lawless human opportunists. A show of royal power kept the vultures away. The next day, still tens of millions of miles out, Drake rolled out of bed to discover 2 welcome bits of news waiting for him. Smythe had picked up chatter on military channels indicating that the Royal Navy vessels had departed the system shortly before Ajax's arrival. They'd gone off to investigate unusual Empire fleet movements near the frontier. Better still, scans had picked up their target. It was Henry Upton, an aging galleon named after one of the founders of the York Company, and a pioneer of the trade that carried sugar, gold, and slaves in a triangle between Albion, the Ladino worlds, and the Hroom homelands. Henry Upton had jumped into the system between Hot Barza and her sister planet, an ocean world, with the unimaginative name of Cold Barza, given because it was locked in an ice age. If the jump point hadn't currently been located on the opposite side of Hot Barza's orbit, she'd have arrived, carrying her slave cargo within a few hours. Commander Tolvern was fidgeting madly in the war room as she briefed Drake on these developments, her words coming out faster than a cobalt cannon on automatic fire. Smythe and Cap were also in the room, their fingers flying over handheld computers, barely paying attention to the commander.
"Excellent news," Drake said when Tolvern paused to take a breath.
"Smythe, what is Henry Upton's top speed?"
Oh, yes, here we go. She's got a single nuclear engine, max speed 500 miles per second.
He thumbed at his screen, and the captain had the distinct impression he was moving back and forth between technical specifications and something personal.
What the devil are you doing there?
Tolvern said.
Writing your memoir.
Multitasking, he said.
Tolvern snorted.
Probably playing Romans versus Soviets again.
Smythe blushed, and this time Drake thought she was closer to the mark.
Anyway,
Smythe said,
I give the slaver 3 days until she's in range of the plasma tugs that will tow her into Hot Barca.
This was a relief. He'd half expected to arrive and find Henry Upton already in orbit, her slaves being shuttled to the surface. He didn't have the crew or the armaments to run Hot Barca's fortresses and take the fight to the surface.
"Even better than that," Smythe added. "The galleon is so slow that she's coming in for a slingshot around Cold Barca to shave a few hours off the trip."
It was a common tactic for slower merchant ships. The idea was to whip around a planet, using the gravitational pull to boost its speed toward its final destination. Drake leaned forward in his chair.
"Cap, can we get there first?"
The corporal flashed a toothy, predator-like smile.
"Aye, 6 hours until Henry Upton shows up, we can get to Cold Barca in 3. "You see?" Tolvern said, her voice rising in excitement. "Talk about lucky."
It did seem unusually fortunate. He could lurk around the backside of Cold Barca, and the galleon wouldn't spot them until he'd pounced. They'd have maybe 5 minutes of warning to send a distress signal. By the time help came, Drake would have his prize and be fleeing toward a safe jump point. And with the 3rd fleet shipped off, there would only be a few patrol boats and short-range fighters to give chase anyway. But experience had taught him to be suspicious of luck. As even the ancients had noted, any battle plan fell apart at first contact with the enemy. The key was not to get caught with your trousers down when that happened. Smythe looked up from his computer and pushed back his glasses.
"Barker wants to know which weapon systems to bring online."
"The biggest risk is stumbling into a trap," he said. "What I want..."
Cap snorted.
"Out here? How do you figure they'd spring a trap? Fill the galleon with explosives or something?" "Let the captain speak," Tolvern said, tone peevish.
"What I want," Drake continued, "is shields up at all times. No cannon, no missiles. We're not here to kill anyone, and we're not here because of romantic notions about freeing slaves or any such rubbish. One and only one slave, that's all we care about."
"What if they start shooting?" Tolvern asked. "Henry Upton is unescorted, so I figure she's carrying light armaments."
"Nothing we can't handle. She's going slow enough we shouldn't have trouble harpooning her. If she gets testy, we'll knock her around a little with the chase gun."
"We need a boarding party," Tolvern said. "Hard to manage without Marines on board."
Cap flexed her arms.
"I'm a Marine. Give me a gun and saber and I'll go aboard." "Funny," Tolvern said. "I thought you aspired to be a pilot." "Okay, that's one. I suppose I'd better make 2 so I can keep an eye on this one."
She nodded toward Cap.
"This I'd like to see," Cap said. "I imagine you waving around a saber all dainty-like."
Tolvern sprang to her feet, bristling, but Drake grimaced and motioned for his first mate to sit back down. Yes, this insubordination was intolerable, but they wouldn't be serving with the woman or her fellow criminals much longer. For now, better to keep the peace.
"You'll stay here," Drake said to Tolvern. "I'll lead the boarding party myself. I need to see what's going on. If there's anything else afoot here, I need to know."
"But, Captain..."
"If anything happens to me, you'll be needed here."
"Yes, sir."
"That's 2, Drake said. "Who else?"
"I know 3 blokes who'd be keen to get some action," Cap said. "And what kind of action would that be?"
Tolvern asked innocently.
"Commander," Drake said.
"Sorry, sir."
"I'd rather not have your blokes, as you put it," Drake told Cap. "One wild card is more than enough."
He glanced at the tech officer, who was still doing something on the computer. "Smythe."
"Me, Captain,"
he squeaked, which drew a snort from Cap and a sigh from Tolvern. Smythe licked his lips, turning pale. He looked every bit the Royal Marine, with his natural physique and strong jaw. Everything except the squinting eyes behind glasses and the full reddish lips.
"No, not you. Get Barker. Ask him if he's got anyone in weapons or engineering he can spare. He won't like it. He's more undermanned than anyone. But our shields will be up anyway, so there shouldn't be much trouble while we're out." As predicted, Barker wasn't happy with this,
but eventually the gunner found two men he said he could spare. One was a former Special Forces fellow by the name of Oglethorpe, who'd been transferred into gunnery after getting his shoulder messed up in combat. He'd lost most of the motor control in one arm, but he was still a big, intimidating fellow. The other was Manx, the bosun, currently at work repairing hull damage from their engagement outside Albion. The man's only experience with weaponry came from basic training, but he was healthy and game. Drake remembered how he'd filled in on the bridge during the mutiny, and figured the man was steady enough. That made four in the boarding party. The captain needed a fifth, and as Smythe cut the channel with Barker, Drake eyed Cap across the table.
"I'm telling you," she said. "You want someone good, you should take my mate Carvalho. He's real handy with a gun."
"Captain," Tolvern said in a warning tone. Drake ignored her. "Good enough, Corporal. I'll take a chance." He rose. "That will be all." Soon they were pulling in behind Cold Barca, the icy world white and glittering beneath them. The only ice-free water was a thin belt girdling the equator, and from space one couldn't discern the difference between glacier-covered land and frozen ocean. A small rust-colored moon came wobbling into view, tracing its rapid path around the planet. Drake met the four others from the boarding party in the armory to get them acquainted with the boarding rocket and pressure suits. He repeated his plans for going on to Henry Upton, explained about the harpoon and tether. "And no shooting unless shot at," he said, as he pulled on the pressurized trousers. "Is that clear?" They nodded. Oglethorpe and Manx seemed relieved, while Cap and Carvalho looked disappointed. He ordered them to suit up while he hurried back to the bridge to check the situation one last time. Tolvern eyed the captain.
"We just picked up Henry Upton. She'll be coming around the planet in 18 minutes.
"Still alone?"
"So far as we can tell."
"If it's a trap," he said, "and I find myself in trouble, don't be a hero. Just get out of here as fast as you can."
"Hm.
Tolvern, that's an order. Do not come for me. Cut the tether and run. Am I understood?" She narrowed her eyes.
"Sir, with all due respect, I could tell you, yes, I would abandon you. But I think we both know what I will do in the heat of battle."
Chapter 6 Vigilant came in quietly, trailing Henry Upton at a distance of 11,500 miles. The slaver didn't know Vigilant was there, because Rutherford had never warned her. He couldn't risk Drake having a spy on the galleon who could tip him off. Instead, Rutherford had waited, cloaked, at the jump point, until Henry Upton came through, and then followed stealthily. Rutherford had half expected his old friend to ambush the galleon at the jump point. But the next most likely spot was Cold Barca, where the lumbering galleon meant to fling herself around the planet to slightly increase her pathetic speed as she came in toward the tugs that would haul her into Hot Barca. And so, Rutherford had shields down and weapons on standby as they approached the ice-covered planet. Just inside 1,000,000 miles of the planet, his tech officer reported the wake of plasma engines. Something big and fast had passed nearby a few hours earlier. Military, most likely, although the wake was too washed out to glean more than that. Rutherford's pulse quickened. Admiral Malthorn had sent off the Third Fleet, and nothing else in the system was big enough to leave that kind of signature. Nothing but Vigilant, or Ajax, that was. The bridge was tense. Commander Pitsfield was in contact with the gun decks and engineering, and there was chatter going back and forth that Rutherford did his best to block out.
"Engineering is asking to bring down the cloaks," Pitsfield said.
"Negative," Rutherford said.
"But, sir, that leaves us vulnerable to laser fire."
Rutherford fought down an angry retort, instead giving Pitsfield a withering stare. The commander turned quickly back to his computer display.
"Leave the cloaks up,"
Pitsfield said into his comlink.
"Captain's orders."
It wasn't that Pitsfield was wrong. Cloaking interfered with the primary shields, laser and other concentrated energy fire that would otherwise be deflected harmlessly into space could cut right through the hull, even saw it right in two if placed properly. But there were only two ways to detect a Punisher-class cruiser under cloaking. First was detecting the wake of its engines, as he'd done with Ajax. But that's why Rutherford was drafting in Henry Upton's wake. Second was an array of listener whisperers, waiting silently to send their reports. There's no way Drake had set up such a defense. He lacked both the equipment and the time. It was the questioning of his orders that drew Rutherford's ire. Earlier in his career, he'd have ordered a man flogged for insubordination at such a crucial moment. That anger sometimes got him in trouble. He'd often thought, since Drake's fall, that he'd been the one destined to kill his career with a blunder. Most likely, Rutherford had always figured, he would draw his sidearm and shoot someone who'd aggravated him. If it was an enlisted man, he'd probably escape the subsequent inquiry. But if it was an officer, unlikely. He was still struggling with his anger when Henry Upton came in at Cold Barsa and bent its trajectory to whip around the planet. It vanished on the screen as it disappeared over the horizon of the cool white sphere beneath them. At 500 miles a second, the two ships would circumnavigate the planet in less than a minute, and Vigilant would have her in sight again. Rutherford still didn't like losing sight of the other ship, not for a single moment. He counted the seconds, the icy surface of Cold Barsa nearly a blur below as they hurtled around after the galleon. They came around the other side, and the viewscreen found Henry Upton. But she was no longer alone. The fat, turtle-like craft was still lumbering forward. But there, next to it, lay the long, lean shape of a Punisher-class cruiser. Its shields were up, the golden rampant lions stretching brilliantly alongside, the sun catching them in all their glory. Blackened scarring marked the surface, where she and Vigilant had traded blows less than 2 weeks earlier. Less than a minute had passed, yet already Ajax had harpooned the galleon like it was a star leviathan, the vast beasts that roamed the depths of space. Drake meant to board the vessel.
"Drop cloaking!" Rutherford cried. "Present starboard guns!"
Drake flew along the tether toward the slaver galleon with the rest of the boarding party. The five of them wore pressure suits with helmets and sat astride a boarding rocket, which looked like a giant green banana with a long tungsten steel ramming snout and hot gases venting out the backside. Both ships, the tether, and the five men and women flying between them were hurtling through space at several hundred miles per second, but the moon and planet were eclipsed behind Ajax, with nothing but the starry void ahead. He couldn't feel the enormous forward speeds, only the few hundred miles an hour zipping them the mile or so between the two ships. Jane's stern voice sounded in his helmet.
"Deceleration in 3 seconds."
Drake was strapped into his seat, every bit of him clamped tightly onto the boarding rocket, but the rapid deceleration shoved him forward against his restraints. The ugly, pitted surface of Henry Upton loomed. The nose of the banana launched free, spouting its own rocket. It followed the tether to the nose of the harpoon, which had expanded to open a passage to let them through the outer hull. The ram-like protrusion now disappeared inside. There was a flash of light. Gases and debris came venting into the void. It slammed against him as they burst through. Then they were inside and tumbling free of the boarding rocket as it released its restraints. They were between the two hulls, both inner and outer now breached, with air venting into space, rushing past them like a hurricane. The ship lurched as Drake and his companion struggled forward to get in past the inner hull before the breach was sealed. They were at the edge of the anti-grav field, and he still felt semi-weightless, bouncing along from step to step. He grabbed the wall to keep from stumbling, then bent to help Manx, who had fallen. At first he thought the ship's movement was the galleon pilot attempting evasive maneuvers. It had been less than a minute since Ajax harpooned her, and so far Henry Upton had given no indication that she knew she was being boarded.
"Captain!"
Tolvern's tense voice said from inside his helmet as he got Manx to his feet.
"We've got trouble!"
Use the chase gun. Show them who's boss.
He was surprised that the galleon would be so foolish as to shoot at them, but it wouldn't take much to settle matters.
It's vigilant. Came in behind the galleon. Must have been cloaked.
Drake muttered an oath. Are they shooting?
No, Rutherford is demanding our surrender.
Rutherford, blasted. Where the devil had he come from? Whatever he'd done, it had been a clever maneuver, and as luck would have it, he'd caught Drake off his own ship. What would he do now? Was he ruthless enough to finish the job? Drake thought he was. There was shouting on Tolvern's end, but she'd covered the comlink or pulled away, and he couldn't pick up what she was saying. Then she came back on.
He's testing our shields. I need to break the tether and evade. I'll come back for you.
Don't break free. Pull in closer. Hug the slaver tight.
But...
She started to protest, then seemed to get what he was driving at.
Yes, sir.
During this conversation, Drake and the others had gained the inner hull, and now removed their helmets and tossed them back over their shoulders, where they hung by their straps. Cap had one gun out, a standard-issue assault rifle, with another dangling from her waist. This was a non-regulation hand cannon. The others, Oglethorpe, Carvalho, and the bosun, Manx, each had pistols and assault rifles. Carvalho also wore a saber, as well as a bandolier of grenades. Where the blazes had that come from? For that matter, where had Cap found her hand cannon? The five of them stepped into the corridor, just as two crew members opened the airlock at the end of the hall and came running toward them. One was human, the other Hroom, tall and thin, with pale pinkish skin and a high, bald forehead. They wore bulky packs, with hoses and nozzles in hand. They'd evidently come to spray the breach with a rapidly expanding foam, a temporary patch until engineering could more permanently seal the hull. They were coming at a run, and had so much momentum that they were halfway down the hallway before they seemed to register the intruders. The pair came to a full stop, turned, and began to run in the opposite direction.
Stop, Drake ordered, or I'll shoot.
They didn't stop. Cap lifted her rifle and squeezed off two shots. The human fell. The Hroom came to an immediate halt and raised his hands. Cap and Carvalho ran past the dead man and grabbed the arms of the Hroom, who stood head and shoulders above them.
Manx, Drake said. Seal the breach.
As the bosun grabbed the pack and nozzle from the dead man, the captain, followed by Oglethorpe, strode up to Cap.
What the hell are you doing?
Cap was stripping off the Hroom's pack and checking for weapons.
He told him he'd shoot.
That's what I told them, you fool. I told you there would be no shooting unless shot at. And you killed the human, too. Why did you do that?
She turned to the Hroom to face the captain.
This one is an eater. I figured he'd be more cooperative.
The he was actually a she, Drake could see now. Taller than a male, with large eyes and even more delicate facial bones. Cap was right about the other part, though. A Hroom's natural skin tone was mottled reddish-orange, like the leaves of a maple tree in autumn. It was the color of the jungles of their homeworlds, where it was said they'd evolved to blend with the colors of the giant woody ferns. But when Hroom turned into eaters, the pigments bled from their skin until they had a grayish-pink hue, like this one. Tolvern spoke into Drake's ear.
Rutherford is giving us 30 seconds, then he'll shoot.
I need 5 minutes.
Damn it, Captain, I told you, we don't have 5 minutes.
Her voice was even more strained than before.
Deal with it, Commander.
Drake cut the link. She'd better figure it out in a hurry. Circumstances had left them short-handed, forced Drake to lead the away party himself, and that meant there was no other leadership on board Ajax but his commander. There was nothing he could do from here except jeopardize his own chances on board the slave ship. He turned to the Hroom.
I'm looking for Nib Pim. Do you know him? Where is he?
You have...
The Hroom began in her high, cooing voice. She licked her lips.
You have sugar to eat.
Do I look like I'm carrying sugar? Of course I don't. Do you know Nib Pim, yes or no?
I have sugar,
Cap said. The Marine reached into one of the pockets in her suit and pulled out a fistful of sugar packets. They were the size used for sweetening tea, but slavers sometimes used them to tempt children and thereby spread the addiction. It wasn't much,
A full-grown room like the one facing them might eat 2 or 3 pounds of the stuff a day.
"Where did you get that?" he demanded.
"We're on a Hroom slave ship," Cap said. "Seemed like it might come in handy. I visited the mess and asked Cook to unlock the sugar cabinet."
She held out a sugar packet for the Hroom, who grabbed at it.
"Uh-uh," Cap warned and pulled it away.
Carvalho jabbed his gun to push back the Hroom, who was looking like she'd leap for Cap to get her hands on the stuff.
"You lead us to our pilot and you can have the sugar," he said. "Name is Nib Pim."
The mere sight of the fistful of sugar packets had set the Hroom trembling. She couldn't stop staring at it. The slave galleon had been traveling for many days through the void, and Drake wondered if the sugar rations had run out. It was ruthless, uncivilized behavior tempting her like this, but it was effective. The Hroom gave the toss of her head that served the same purpose as a nod did to humans.
"Nib Pim? I not know this Hroom."
She stopped, mouth pinching. This one apparently didn't speak English very well.
"He on ship?"
"Where are the quarters?" Drake asked. "We look for him ourselves. The room's for the slaves," he added when the Hroom looked back in confusion. "Where are they?"
"All together, all in one place."
"Probably one big room," Cap said. "You know how these eaters get. Run out of sugar and they'll go nutso. Better to keep them in a single central location." Drake found it hard to imagine Nib Pim falling so far so fast that he'd go crazy when cut off from something he'd never tasted until a few weeks ago. Henry Upton shuddered beneath their feet. No sound of an explosion reached his ears, but something had hit the ship. He told Tolvern to hug the galleon, thinking this would keep Rutherford from firing. Maybe she'd brought it too close and they'd bumped.
"Take us there," he told the Hroom.
"You come this way,"
she said, and gestured back the direction from which she and her human companion had come. She glanced down at his body, but then she stared at the sugar packets that Cap was zipping back into her pocket. Using the spray sealant taken from the dead man, Manx had been hosing down the inner hull until he'd filled the breach with hardening foam. Now he tossed aside the pack and picked up his rifle. The five of them led their prisoner up the hallway in the direction she'd indicated. Few spaceships were built with comfort in mind, but the slave ship was particularly cramped and claustrophobic. The passageway was slender enough that they were forced to travel in single file, and once they rounded the corner, the Hroom could no longer stand erect, but was forced to bend so low that her long hands nearly dragged on the floor. Drake and the taller members of his crew had to duck to get through airlocks. The air had the oily smell of leaking lubricant, and the tangy, almost citrus-like scent of Hroom. The air grew chill the deeper into the ship they traveled. Slavers were kept cold to pacify the Hroom. They prospered in warm, almost sweltering conditions, but turned sluggish in cold weather. Their guide slowed her pace as they continued. She stopped where the passageway branched, blinking with evident confusion.
"Move it,"
Cap said, and jabbed her rifle into the alien's back. This got the Hroom going again. They squeezed through another open airlock door to find themselves in an even more narrow passageway, this one coming to a dead end. A human soldier with a stun gun stood in front of a door on the far side. He was scowling, his head cocked, as if he were listening to instructions through his earpiece. He spotted the intruders, and his expression changed to alarm.
"They're here!"
he cried to whomever he'd been talking to. He lifted his stun gun.
"Stand back!"
Cap lifted her assault rifle.
"Put that down, or so help me, I'll knock one right through your skull!"
The guard threw down his weapon and put his hands on his head. Drake squeezed past both Cap and the Hroom. He yanked out the guard's earpiece and tossed it to one side. "Open the door."
"The hell I will, it's full of eaters. We didn't have enough sugar for them all."
"Corporal, if he doesn't open this door by the time I count to five, kill him. One..."
The guard slapped his hand against a touchpad outside the door. It scanned his palm. The door hissed open. A blast of cool air rushed out. It was dim in the large open room, and as Drake stepped inside, his eyes struggled to adjust to the soft red lights along the ceiling. It was a vast, cavernous space. The center of the slaver was apparently one huge room, 100 feet square and maybe 15 feet high, bunks stacked to the ceiling, so close one on top of the next that Ahroom was pretty much forced to lie down. And there were 3 or 4 Ahroom per bunk, all jumbled together. Some were naked, others wore rags.
"Nib Pim," he shouted. "It's Drake! Where are you?"
None of the Ahroom answered. Most lay motionless on their cots, their big, liquid black eyes open and unblinking. Others were moaning and thrashing, spittle foaming at their mouth. They saw the 2 humans and began cooing, begging.
"Sugar! Give me sugar! I must eat!"
"Captain," Tolvern said in his calm piece, "I've pulled in the ship. We're breaking through to the bridge. Have you got him?"
"I'll have him in a second. I'll meet you there."
Tolvern's maneuver must have worked. Hauling Ajax in next to the slaver had kept Rutherford from getting a clear shot. With luck, he wasn't shooting at all, not being able to destroy them without also taking down the galleon. Drake scanned the room desperately as he squeezed down the passageway between the stacked bunks. The citrus smell was enough to make one swoon. Cap came after him. She covered her mouth and nose with one hand. She slapped away a long, bony hand that groped for her.
"Disgusting. Absolutely friggin' rubbish," she said.
Drake thought she was talking about the slaves and was about to snap a retort, but then she added,
"I ain't much a fan of the room, but I don't care if it's human, alien, or animal. You treat people like this and you deserve a bullet."
The floor shuddered again. Tolvern spoke up.
"Rutherford is giving it to us. Doesn't seem to care if he takes out the slaver with it. What should I do?"
So much for the hope that Rutherford would show restraint.
"For God's sake, Tolvern, deal with it."
She cut the comm without another word. The ship shuddered. This time he heard the thump of the explosion coming from above and aft of their position, vibrating through the floor. Somewhere, a distant warning alarm sounded. Oglethorpe shouted from the passageway.
"Nib Pim!"
Drake shouted. There was no answer.
"How the blazes are we going to find him?" Cap said. "They all look the same to me in here."
Drake shoved his sidearm into its holster and held out his hand.
"Give me the sugar packets."
"Are you nuts?"
"Give them to me now."
"King's balls, we'll be torn apart."
She fumbled with the zipper of her jumper, where she'd shoved them after tempting the room in the corridor. He grabbed the handful of sugar packets.
"I have sugar. I will give it to the room who finds me Nib Pim. He's in this room."
The room erupted in cries and begging pleas. Hands groped and grabbed, but Cap bashed them away with her rifle butt. One room came scrambling down from an upper bunk, springing from ladder to ladder like a spider. Red light reflected off his eyes, and his lips pulled back in a snarl as he prepared to launch himself. But other hands seized him, and a brawl broke out, which spilled to the floor. Shortly, a mass of biting, hitting bodies clogged the way forward.
"I have Nib Pim!"
someone shouted.
"No, you don't! I have him!"
Hands dragged one of the Hroom forward. He was nearly naked, dressed in rags, and struggling feebly. Drake recognized his pilot, the curve of his nose, and the sharp cheekbones. But as they pushed him forward, an initial feeling of relief gave way to alarm. Nib Pim was in no condition to move. Drake tossed the handful of sugar packets. The Hroom set upon them like starving dogs. He took advantage of the distraction and grabbed Nib Pim by one arm. Cap got the other arm, and they dragged him toward the door. More Hroom came at them, and Drake called for help. Carvalho, Oglethorpe, and Manx waded into the room from the corridor. Carvalho slashed with his saber to clear a path. Soon they had Nib Pim into the hallway,
and the door shut again. Drake took a deep breath of the filtered air, relieved to be out of that suffocating closeness. There was no sign of the human guard who'd let them into the room, but the room was waiting anxiously for the promised sugar. Drake had thrown it all away.
Sugar! Must eat sugar!
Cap found a few more packets in the bottom of her pocket. The room snatched them and shoved them, paper and all, into her mouth. Cap had one more packet, which she tore open. Drake understood what she was about. He gestured at Nib Pim. "Open his mouth," he told Carvalho. Nib Pim had collapsed to the ground and rolled onto his back. Carvalho bent over him and pried his mouth open. Drake took the packet and poured the sugar in. Nib Pim's mouth worked to swallow it. Within a few seconds, the glazed look had cleared from the pilot's face. It was like watching a dead body rise from the embalming table, the dead eyes blinking and looking about him. His gaze fixed on Drake, who returned an encouraging smile. Sirens were wailing, and another explosion thumped through the ship. Recognition dawned on the room's face.
"No, I don't want to. Put me back."
"You're not yourself. We'll..." Nib Pim sprang to his feet. He swung wildly at Drake. Acting on pure instinct, the captain flattened himself against the side of the corridor. The blow glanced off his cheek. Cap and Carvalho set into him with their rifle butts. Drake ordered them to stop. The other room had finished the sugar and was already begging for more even before they'd finished subduing the pilot.
"We have more," Drake lied. "Take us to the bridge, and you can have it all." To the others he said, "If Nib Pim won't come willingly, drag him."
"Don't take me,"
Nib Pim begged as they seized him. He struggled, flailing.
"Please, Captain, I need sugar."
Chapter 7. Drake and the rest of the boarding party reached the bridge of the slaver, dragging Nib Pim along. The bridge smelled of chemical retardant and burning plastic. The captain of Henry Upton and three of his officers were spraying a wall of computer equipment to put out an electrical fire. Lights flashed, warning voices and sirens sounded from every corner. The slaver crew didn't see the intruders until Carvalho and Cap were on top of them. Soon the crew was disarmed and standing in a sullen knot against the blackened, smoking bank of equipment. The captain was a sallow, jowly man, about 45 or 50, with thinning hair and a belly that overhung his belt. He wore a faded merchant uniform and presented a slovenly appearance as he looked over his captors. His gaze fixed on Nib Pim, who was being held upright by Ogre.